Recorded Books presents Grendel by John Gardner, narrated by George Guidel.
Chapter 1. The old ram stands looking down over rock slides, stupidly triumphant. I blink. I stare in horror. Scat! I hiss. Go back to your cave. Go back to your cowshed. Whatever. He cocks his head like an elderly, slow-witted king, considers the angles, decides to ignore me. I stamp. I hammer the ground with my fists. I hurl a skull-sized stone at him. He will not budge. I shake my two hairy fists at the sky, and I let out a howl so unspeakable that the water at my feet turns sudden ice, and even I myself am left uneasy. But the ram stays. The season is upon us. And so begins the 12th year of my idiotic war. The pain of it. The stupidity. Ah, well, I sigh and shrug, trudge back to the trees. Do not think my brains are squeezed shut like the ram's by the roots of horns. Flanks a-tremble, eyes like stones, he stares at as much of the world as he can see, and feels it surging in him, filling his chest as the melting snow fills dried-out creek beds, tickling his gross, lopsided balls, and charging his brains with the same unrest that made him suffer last year at this time, and the year before, and the year before that. He's forgotten them all. His hind parts shiver with the usual joyful, mindless ache to mount whatever happens near. The storm piling up black towers to the west, some rotting, docile stump, some spraddle-legged yew. I cannot bear to look. Why can't these creatures discover a little dignity? I ask the sky. The sky says nothing, predictably. I make a face, uplift a defiant middle finger, and give an obscene little kick. The sky ignores me, forever unimpressed. Him, too, I hate. The same as I hate these brainless budding trees, these brattling birds. Not, of course, that I fool myself with thoughts that I'm more noble. Pointless, ridiculous monster. Crouched in the shadows, stinking of dead men, murdered children, martyred cows. I am neither proud nor ashamed, understand, one more dull victim, leering at seasons that never were meant to be observed. Ah, sad one, poor old freak. I cry and hug myself and laugh, letting out salt tears, hee hee. Till I fall down, gasping and sobbing. It's mostly fake. The sun spins mindlessly overhead. The shadows lengthen and shorten as if by plan. Small birds, with a high-pitched yelp, lay eggs. The tender grasses peek up, innocent yellow, through the ground. The children of the dead. It was just here, this shocking green, that once when the moon was tombed in clouds, I tore off sly old Athelgard's head. Here, where the startling tiny jaws of crocuses snap at the late winter sun like the heads of baby water snakes, here I killed the old woman with the iron gray hair. She tasted of urine and spleen, which made me spit. Sweet mulch for yellow blooms. Such are the tiresome memories of a shadow-shooter, earth-rim-roamer, walker of the world's weird wall. "Wah!" I cry, with another quick, nasty face at the sky, mournfully observing the way it is, bitterly remembering the way it was. and idiotically casting tomorrow's nets. Arg! Yaw! I reel, smash trees. Disfigured son of lunatics. The big bold oaks gaze down at me, yellow with mourning, beneath complexity. No offense, I say, with a terrible sycophantish smile, and tip an imaginary hat. It was not always like this, of course. On occasion it's been worse. No matter. No matter. The doe in the clearing goes stiff at sight of my horridness, then remembers her legs and is gone. It makes me cross. Blind prejudice, I bawl at the splintered sunlight, where half a second ago she stood. I wring my fingers, put on a long face. Ah, the unfairness of everything, I say, and shake my head. It is a matter of fact that I have never killed a deer in all my life, and never will. Cows have more meat, and locked up in pens are easier to catch. It is true, perhaps, that I feel some trifling dislike of deer, but no more dislike than I feel for other natural things, discounting men. But deer, like rabbits and bears and even men, can make, concerning my race, no delicate distinctions. That is their happiness. They see all life without observing it. They're buried in it like crabs in mud. Except men, of course. I'm not in a mood, just yet, to talk of men. So it goes with me, day by day, and age by age, I tell myself. Locked in the deadly progression of moon and stars. I shake my head, muttering darkly on shaded paths, holding conversation with the only friend and comfort this world affords, my shadow. Wild pigs clatter away through brush. A baby bird falls feet up in my path, squeaking. With a crabby laugh, I let him lie. Kind heaven's merciful bounty to some sick fox. So it goes with me, age by age, talking. Talking, spinning a web of words, pale walls of dreams, between myself and all I see. The first grim stirrings of springtime come, as I knew they must, having seen the ram. And even under the ground where I live, where no light breaks but the red of my fires, and nothing stirs but the flickering shadows on my wet rock walls, or scampering rats on my piles of bones, or my mother's fat, foul bulk rolling over, restless again, molested by nightmares, old memories. I am aware, in my chest, of tuber stirrings in the black, sweet duff of the forest overhead. I feel my anger coming back, building up like invisible fire. And at last, when my soul can no longer resist, I go up, as mechanical as anything else, fists clenched against my lack of will, my belly growling, mindless as wind, for blood. I swim up through the fire snakes, hot, dark whale cocks prowling the luminous green of the mere, and I surface with a gulp among churning waves and smoke. I crawl up onto the bank and catch my breath. It's good at first to be out in the night, naked to the cold mechanics of the stars. Space hurls outward, falcon swift, mounting like an irreversible injustice, a final disease. The cold night air is reality at last. Indifferent to me as a stone face carved on a high cliff wall to show that the world is abandoned. So childhood, too, feels good at first. Before one happens to notice the terrible sameness, age after age. I lie there, resting in the steaming grass, the old lake hissing and gurgling behind me, whispering patterns of words my sanity resists. At last, heavy as an ice-capped mountain, I rise and work my way to the inner wall, beginning of Wolf Slopes, the edge of my realm. I stand in the high wind, balanced, blackening the night with my stench, gazing down to cliffs that fall away to cliffs, and once again I am aware of my potential. I could die. I cackle with rage and suck in breath. Dark chasms, I scream from the cliff edge, seize me to your foul black bowels and crush my bones. I am terrified at the sound of my own huge voice in the darkness. I stand there shaking from head to foot, moved to the deep sea depths of my being like a creature thrown into audience with thunder. At the same time, I am secretly unfooled. The uproar is only my own shriek, and chasms are, like all things vast, inanimate. They will not snatch me in a thousand years, unless, in a lunatic fit of religion, I jump. I sigh, depressed, and grind my teeth. I toy with shouting some tidbit more, some terrifying, unthinkable threat, some blackly fuliginous, riddling hex. But my heart's not in it. "Missed me," I say, with a coy little jerk and a leer, to keep my spirits up. Then, with a sigh, a kind of moan, I start very carefully down the cliffs that lead to the fens and moors, and Hrothgar's hall. Owls cross my path as silently as raiding ships, and at the sound of my foot lean wolves rise, glance at me awkwardly, and, neat of step as lizards, sneak away. I used to take some pride in that. The caution of owls when my shape looms in, the alarm I stir in these giant northern wolves. I was younger then, still playing cat and mouse with the universe. I move down through the darkness, burning with murderous lust, my brains raging at the sickness I can observe in myself as objectively as might a mind 10 centuries away. Stars spattered out through lifeless night from end to end, like jewels scattered in a dead king's grave. Tease, torment my wits toward meaningful patterns that do not exist. I can see for miles from these rock walls, thick forest suddenly still at my coming, cowering stags, wolves, hedgehogs, boars, submerged in their stifling, unmemorable fear. Mute birds, pulsating, thoughtless clay in hushed old trees. Thick limbs interlocked to seal drab secrets in. I sigh, sink into the silence, and cross it like wind. Behind my back, at the world's end, my pale, slightly glowing, fat mother sleeps on, old, sick at heart, in our dingy underground room. Life bloated, baffled, long-suffering hag. Guilty, she imagines, of some unremembered, perhaps ancestral crime. She must have some human in her. Not that she thinks, not that she dissects and ponders the dusty mechanical bits of her miserable life's curse. She clutches at me in her sleep as if to crush me. I break away. "Why are we here?" I used to ask her. "Why do we stand this putrid, stinking hole?" She trembles at my words. Her fat lips shake. "Don't ask," her wiggling claws implore. She never speaks. "Don't ask." It must be some terrible secret, I used to think. I'd give her a crafty squint. "She'll tell me in time," I thought. But she told me nothing. I waited on. That was before the old dragon, calm as winter, unveiled the truth. He was not a friend. And so I come through trees and towns to the lights of Hrothgar's mead hall. I am no stranger here, a respected guest. 11 years now, and going on 12, I have come up this clean mown central hill, dark shadow out of the woods below, and have knocked politely on the high oak door, bursting its hinges and sending the shock of my greeting inward like a cold blast out of a cave. "Grendel," they squeak, and I smile like exploding spring. The old shaper, a man I cannot help but admire, goes out the back window with his harp at a single bound, though blind as a bat. The drunkest of Hrothgar's thanes come reeling and clanking down from their wall-hung beds, all shouting their meaty, outrageous boasts, their heavy swords a-swirl like eagles' wings. "Woe! Woe! Woe!" cries Hrothgar, hoary with winters, peeking in, wide-eyed, from his bedroom in back. His wife, looking in behind him, makes a scene. The thanes in the mead hall blow out the lights and cover the wide stone fireplace with shields. I laugh, crumple over. I can't help myself. In the darkness I alone see clear as day. While they squeal and screech and bump into each other, I silently sack up my dead and withdraw to the woods. I eat and laugh and eat, until I can barely walk, my chest hair matted with dribbled blood. And then the roosters on the hill crow, and dawn comes over the roofs of the houses. And all at once I am filled with gloom again. "This is some punishment sent us," I hear them bawling from the hill. My head aches. Morning nails my eyes. "Some god is angry," I hear a woman keen. "The people of Shild and Herogar and Hrothgar are mired in sin." My belly rumbles, sick on their sour meat. I crawl through blood-stained leaves to the eaves of the forest, and there peek out. The dogs fall silent at the edge of my spell, and where the king's hall surmounts the town, the blind old shaper, harp clutched tight to his fragile chest, stares futilely down, straight at me. Otherwise nothing. Pigs root dully at the posts of a wooden fence. A rumple-horned ox lies chewing in dew and shade. A few men, lean, wearing animal skins, look up at the gables of the king's hall, or at the vultures circling casually beyond. Hrothgar says nothing. Hoar-frost bearded, his features cracked and crazed. Inside, I hear the people praying, whimpering, whining, mumbling, pleading to their numerous sticks and stones. He doesn't go in. The king has lofty theories of his own. "Theories," I whisper to the blood-stained ground. So the dragon once spoke. They'd map out roads through hell with their crackpot theories. I recall his laugh. Then the groaning and praying stop, and on the side of the hill the dirge slow shoveling begins. They throw up a mound for the funeral pyre, for whatever arms or legs or heads my haste has left behind. Meanwhile, up in the shattered hall, the builders are hammering, replacing the door, for it must be the 50th or 60th time, industrious and witless as worker ants, except that they make small, foolish changes, adding a few more iron pegs, more iron bands, with tireless dogmatism. Now, fire. A few little lizard tongues, then healthy flames reaching up through the tangled nest of sticks. A feeble-minded crow could have fashioned a neater nest. A severed leg swells up and bursts, then an arm, then another, and the red fire turns on the blackening flesh and makes it sizzle, and it reaches higher, up and up into greasy smoke, turning like falcons at warplay, rushing like circling wolves up into the swallowing, indifferent sky. And now, by some lunatic theory, they throw on golden rings, old swords, and braided helmets. They wail, the whole crowd, women and men, a kind of song, like a single quavering voice. The song rings up like the greasy smoke, and their faces shine with sweat and something that looks like joy. The song swells, pushes through woods and sky, and they're singing now as if by some lunatic theory they had won. I shake with rage. The red sun blinds me, churns up my belly to nausea, and the heat thrown out of the bone fire burns my skin. I cringe, clawing my flesh, and flee for home. Chapter 2. Talking. Talking, spinning a spell. Pale skin of words that closes me in like a coffin. Not in a language that anyone any longer understands. Rushing, degenerate mutter of noises I send out before me wherever I creep, like a dragon burning his way through vines and fog. I used to play games when I was young. It might as well be 1,000 years ago. Explored our far-flung underground world in an endless war game of leaps onto nothing. Ingenious twists into freedom or new perplexity, quick whispered plottings with invisible friends. Wild cackles when vengeance was mine. I nosed out in my childish games every last shark-toothed chamber and hall, every black tentacle of my mother's cave. And so came at last, adventure by adventure, to the pool of fire snakes. I stared, mouth gaping. They were gray as old ashes, faceless, eyeless. They spread the surface of the water with pure green flame. I knew, I seemed to have known all along, that the snakes were there to guard something. Inevitably, after I'd stood there a while, rolling my eyes back along the dark hallway, my ears cocked for my mother's step, I screwed my nerve up and dove. The fire snakes scattered as if my flesh were charmed. And so I discovered the sunken door. And so I came up, for the first time, to moonlight. I went no farther that first night, but I came out again, inevitably. I played my way farther out into the world, vast cavern above ground. cautiously darting from tree to tree, challenging the terrible forces of night on tiptoe. At dawn, I fled back. I lived those years, as do all young things, in a spell. Like a puppy nipping, playfully growling, preparing for battle with wolves. At times the spell would be broken suddenly, on shelves or in hallways of my mother's cave. Large old shapes with smoldering eyes sat watching me. A continuous grumble came out of their mouths. Their backs were humped. Then, little by little, it dawned on me that the eyes that seemed to bore into my body were, in fact, gazing through it, wearily indifferent to my slight obstruction of the darkness. Of all the creatures I knew in those days, only my mother really looked at me, stared at me as if to consume me like a troll. She loved me, in some mysterious sense I understood, without her speaking it. I was her creation. We were one thing, like the wall and the rock growing out from it. Or so I ardently, desperately affirmed. When her strange eyes burned into me, it did not seem quite sure. I was intensely aware of where I sat, the volume of darkness I displaced, the shiny, smooth span of packed dirt between us, and the shocking separateness from me in my mama's eyes. I would feel, all at once, alone and ugly, almost as if I'd dirtied myself, obscene. The cavern river rumbled far below us. Being young, unable to face these things, I would bawl and hurl myself at my mother, and she would reach out her claws and seize me, though I could see I alarmed her. I had teeth like a saw, and she would smash me to her fat, limp breast as if to make me a part of her flesh again. After that, comforted, I would gradually ease back out into my games. Crafty-eyed, wicked as an elderly wolf, I would scheme with or stalk my imaginary friends, projecting the self I meant to become into every dark corner of the cave and the woods above. Then, all at once, there they'd be again, the indifferent, burning eyes of the strangers, or my mother's eyes. Again, my world would be suddenly transformed, fixed like a rose with a nail through it, space hurtling coldly out from me in all directions. But I didn't understand. One morning, I caught my foot in the crack where two old tree trunks joined. "Aup!" I yelled. "Mama! Wah!" I was out much later than I'd meant to be. As a rule, I was back in the cave by dawn, but that day I'd been lured out farther than usual by the heavenly scent of newborn calf. Ah, sweeter than flowers, as sweet as my mama's milk. I looked at the foot in anger and disbelief. It was wedged deep, as if the two oak trees were eating it. Black sawdust, squirrel dust, was spattered up the leg almost to the thigh. I'm not sure now how the accident happened. I must have pushed the two boles apart as I stepped up into the place where they joined. And then, when I stupidly let go again, they closed on my foot like a trap. Blood gushed from my ankle and shin, and pain flew up through me like fire up the flue of a mountain. I lost my head. I bellowed for help so loudly it made the ground shake. "Mama! Wah! Wah!" I bellowed to the sky, the forest, the cliffs, until I was so weak from loss of blood I could barely wave my arms. "I'm going to die!" I wailed. "Poor Grendel! Poor old Mama!" I wept and sobbed. "Poor Grendel will hang here and starve to death," I told myself, "and no one will ever even miss him." The thought enraged me. I hooted. I thought of my mother's foreign eyes staring at me from across the room. I thought of the cool, indifferent eyes of the others. I shrieked in fear. Still, no one came. The sun was up now, and even filtered as it was through the lacy young leaves, it made my head hurt. I twisted around as far as I could, hunting wildly for her shape on the cliffs, but there was nothing, or rather there was everything but my mother. Thing after thing tried, cynical and cruel, to foist itself off as my mama's shape, a black rock balanced at the edge of the cliff, a dead tree casting a long-armed shadow, a running stag, a cave entrance, each thing trying to detach itself, lift itself out of the general meaningless scramble of objects, but falling back, melting to the blank, infuriating clutter of not my mother. My heart began to race. I seemed to see the whole universe, even the sun and sky, leaping forward, then sinking away again, decomposing. Everything was wreckage, putrefaction. If she were there, the cliffs, the brightening sky, the trees, the stag, the waterfall, would suddenly snap into position around her, sane again, well organized. But she was not. And the morning was crazy. Its green brilliance jabbed at me, live needles. "Please, Mama," I sobbed as if heartbroken. Then, some 30 feet away, there was a bull. He stood looking at me with his head lowered, and the world snapped into position around him, as if in league with him. I must have been closer to the calf than I had guessed, since he'd arrived to protect it. Bulls do such things, though they don't even know that the calves they defend are theirs. He shook his horns at me, as if scornful. I trembled. On the ground, on 2 good feet, I would have been more than a match for the bull, or if not, I could have outrun him. But I was 4 or 5 feet up in the air, trapped and weak. He could slam me right out of the tree with one blow of that boned square head, maybe tearing the foot off, and then he could gore me to death at his leisure in the grass. He pawed the ground, looking at me up from under. Murderous. "Go away," I said. "Hist!" It had no effect. I bellowed at him. He jerked his head as if the sound were a boulder I'd thrown at him. But then he merely stood considering, and after a minute, he pawed the ground again. Again I bellowed. This time he hardly noticed it. He snorted through his nose and pawed more deeply, spattering grass and black earth at his sharp rear hooves. As if time had slowed down, as it does for the dying, I watched him loll his weight forward, sliding into an easy lope, head tilted, coming toward me in a casual arc. He picked up speed, throwing his weight onto his huge front shoulders, crooked tail lifted behind him like a flag. When I screamed, he didn't even flick an ear, but came on, driving like an avalanche now, thunder booming from his hooves across the cliffs. The same instant he struck my tree, he jerked his head, and flame shot up my leg. The tip of one horn had torn me to the knee. But that was all. The tree shuddered as he banged it with his skull, and he pivoted around it, stumbling. He gave his head a jerk, as if clearing his brains, then turned and loped back to where he'd charged me from before. He'd struck too low, and even in my terror I understood that he would always strike too low. He fought by instinct, blind mechanism, ages old. He'd have fought the same way against an earthquake or an eagle. I had nothing to fear from his wrath but that twisting horn. The next time he charged, I kept my eye on it, watched that horn with as much concentration as I'd have watched the rims of a crevasse I was leaping, and at just the right instant I flinched. Nothing touched me but the breeze as the horn flipped past. I laughed. My ankle was numb now, My leg was on fire to the hip. I twisted to search the cliff walls again, but still my mother wasn't there, and my laughter grew fierce. All at once, as if by sudden vision, I understood the emptiness in the eyes of those humpbacked shapes back in the cave. Were they my brothers, my uncles, those creatures shuffling brimstone-eyed from room to room, or sitting separate, isolated, muttering forever like underground rivers, each in his private, inviolable gloom? I understood that the world was nothing, a mechanical chaos of casual brute enmity on which we stupidly impose our hopes and fears. I understood that, finally and absolutely, I alone exist. All the rest, I saw, is merely what pushes me or what I push against, blindly as all that is not myself pushes back. I create the whole universe, blink by blink. An ugly god, pitifully dying in a tree. The bull struck again. I flinched from the horn tip and bellowed with rage and pain. The limbs overhead, stretching out through the clearing like hungry snakes reaching up from their nest, would be clubs if I had them in my two hands, or barricades piled between me and my cave, or kindling down in the room where my mother and I slept. Where they were, above me, they were, what, kind shade? I laughed, a tearful howl. The bull kept on charging. Sometimes, after he hit, he'd fall down and lie panting. I grew limp with my anarchistic laughter. I no longer bothered to jerk back my leg. Sometimes the horn tip tore it, sometimes not. I clung to the tree trunk that slanted off to my right, and I almost slept. Perhaps I did sleep. I don't know. I must have. Nothing mattered. Sometime in the middle of the afternoon, I opened my eyes and discovered that the bull was gone. I slept again, I think. When I woke up this time and looked up through the leaves overhead, there were vultures. I sighed, indifferent. I was growing used to the pain, or it had lessened. Unimportant. I tried to see myself from the vulture's viewpoint. I saw instead my mother's eyes. Consuming. I was suddenly her focus of the general meaninglessness. Not for myself. Not for any quality of my large, shaggy body or my sly, unnatural mind. I was, in her eyes, some meaning I myself could never know and might not care to know. An alien, the rock broken free of the wall. I slept again. That night, for the first time, I saw men. It was dark when I awakened, or when I came to, if it was that. I was aware at once that there was something wrong. There was no sound, not even the honk of a frog or the chirp of a cricket. There was a smell, a fire very different from ours, pungent, painful as thistles to the nose. I opened my eyes, and everything was blurry as though under water. There were lights all around me, like some weird creature's eyes. They jerked back as I looked. Then voices, speaking words. The sounds were foreign at first, but when I calmed myself, concentrating, I found I understood them. It was my own language, but spoken in a strange way, as if the sounds were made by brittle sticks, dried spindles, flaking bits of shale. My vision cleared, and I saw them, mounted on horses, holding torches up.
Some of them had shiny domes, as it seemed to me then, with horns coming out like the bull's. They were small, these creatures, with dead-looking eyes and grey-white faces. And yet, in some ways, they were like us, except ridiculous and, at the same time, mysteriously irritating, like rats. Their movements were stiff and regular, as if figured by logic. They had skinny, naked hands that moved by clicks. When I first became aware of them, they were all speaking at the same time. I tried to move, but my body was rigid. Only one hand gave a jerk. They all stopped speaking at the same instant, like sparrows. We stared at each other. One of them said, a tall one with a long black beard, "It moves independent of the tree." They nodded. The tall one said, "It's a growth of some kind. That's my opinion, some beast-like fungus." They all looked up into the branches. A short, fat one with a tangled white beard pointed up into the tree with an axe. "Those branches on the northern side are all dead there. No doubt the whole tree'll be dead before midsummer. It's always the north side goes first when there ain't enough sap." They nodded. And another one said, "See there where it grows up out of the trunk? Sap running all over." They leaned over the sides of their horses to look, pushing the torches toward me. The horses' eyes glittered. "Have to close that up if we're going to save this tree," the tall one said. The others grunted, and the tall one looked up at my eyes, uneasy. I couldn't move. He stepped down off the horse and came over to me so close I could have swung my hand and smashed his head if I could make my muscles move. "It's like blood," he said, and made a face. Two of the others got down and came over to pull at their noses and look. "I say that tree's a goner," one of them said. They all nodded, except the tall one. "We can't just leave it rot," he said. "Start letting the place go to ruin, and you know what the upshot'll be." They nodded. The others got down off their horses and came over. The one with the tangled white beard said, "Maybe we could chop the fungus out." They thought about it. After a while, the tall one shook his head. "I don't know. Could be it's some kind of a oak tree spirit. Better not to mess with it." They looked uneasy. There was a hairless, skinny one with eyes like two holes. He stood with his arms out, like a challenged bird, and he kept moving around in jerky little circles, bent forward, peering at everything, at the tree, at the woods around, up into my eyes. Now, suddenly, he nodded. "That's it. King's right. It's a spirit." "You think so?" they said, their heads poked forward. "Sure of it," he said. "Is it friendly, you think?" the king said. The hairless one peered up at me with the fingertips of one hand in his mouth. The skinny elbow hung straight down as if he were leaning on an invisible table while he thought the whole thing through. His black little eyes stared straight into mine, as if waiting for me to tell him something. I tried to speak. My mouth moved, but nothing would come out. The little man jerked back. "He's hungry," he said. "Hungry," they all said. "What does he eat?" He looked at me again. His tiny eyes drilled into me, and he was crouched as if he were thinking of trying to jump up into my brains. My heart thudded. I was so hungry I could eat a rock. He smiled suddenly, as if a holy vision had exploded in his head. "He eats pig," he said. He looked doubtful. "Or maybe pig smoke. He's in a period of transition." They all looked at me, thinking it over, then nodded. The king picked out six men. "Go get the thing some pigs," he said. The six men said, "Yes, sir," and got on their horses and rode off. It filled me with joy, though it was all crazy, and before I knew I could do it, I laughed. They jerked away and stood shaking, looking up. "The spirit's angry," one of them whispered. "It always has been," another one said. "That's why it's killing the tree." "No, no, you're wrong," the hairless one said. "It's yelling for pig."
"Pig!" I tried to yell. It scared them. They all began shouting at each other. One of the horses neighed and reared up, and for some crazy reason they took it for a sign. The king snatched an axe from the man beside him, and, without any warning, he hurled it at me. I twisted, letting out a howl, and it shot past my shoulder, just barely touching my skin. Blood trickled out. "You're all crazy!" I tried to yell, but it came out a moan. I bellowed for my mother. "Surround him!" the king yelled. "Save the horses!" And suddenly, I knew I was dealing with no dull mechanical bull, but with thinking creatures, pattern makers, the most dangerous things I'd ever met. I shrieked at them, trying to scare them off, but they merely ducked behind bushes and took long sticks from the saddles of their horses, bows and javelins. "You're all crazy," I bellowed. "You're all insane." I'd never howled more loudly in my life. Darts like hot coals went through my legs and arms, and I howled more loudly still. And then, just when I was sure I was finished, a shriek 10 times as loud as mine came blaring off the cliff. It was my mother. She came roaring down like thunder, screaming like 1,000 hurricanes, eyes as bright as dragon fire, and before she was within 1 mile of us, the creatures had leaped to their horses and galloped away. Big trees shattered and fell from her path. The earth trembled. Then her smell poured in like blood into a silver cup, filling the moonlit clearing to the brim. And I felt the 2 trees that held me falling, and I was tumbling free into the grass. I woke up in the cave, warm firelight flickering on walls. My mother lay picking through the bone pile. When she heard me stir, she turned, wrinkling her forehead, and looked at me. There were no other shapes. I think I dimly understood even then that they'd gone deeper into darkness, away from men. I tried to tell her all that had happened, all that I'd come to understand. The meaningless objectness of the world, the universal bruteness. She only stared, troubled at my noise. She'd forgotten all language long ago, or maybe had never known any. I'd never heard her speak to the other shapes. How I myself learned to speak, I can't remember. It was a long, long time ago. But I talked on, trying to smash through the walls of her unconsciousness. "The world resists me, and I resist the world," I said. "That's all there is. The mountains are what I define them as." Ah, monstrous stupidity of childhood, unreasonable hope. I waken with a start and see it over again. In my cave, out walking or sitting by the mirror, the memory rising as if it has been pursuing me. The fire in my mother's eyes brightens, and she reaches out as if some current is tearing us apart. "The world is all pointless accident," I say. Shouting now, my fists clenched. "I exist, nothing else." Her face works. She gets up on all fours, brushing dry bits of bone from her path, and with a look of terror, rising as if by unnatural power, she hurls herself across the void and buries me in her bristly fur and fat. I sicken with fear. "My mother's fur is bristly," I say to myself. "Her flesh is loose." Buried under my mother, I cannot see. She smells of wild pig and fish. "My mother smells of wild pig and fish," I say.
What I see, I inspire with usefulness, I think, trying to suck in breath. And all that I do not see is useless, void. I observe myself observing what I observe. It startles me. Then I am not that which observes. I am lack. A lack. No thread, no frailest hair between myself and the universal clutter. I listen to the underground river. I have never seen it. Talking. Talking. Spinning a skin. A skin. I can't breathe, and I claw to get free. She struggles. I smell my mama's blood, and, alarmed, I hear from the walls and floor of the cave the booming, booming of her heart. Chapter 3. It wasn't because he threw that battle axe that I turned on Hrothgar. That was mere midnight foolishness. I dismissed it, thought of it afterward only as you remember a tree that fell on you, or an adder you stepped on by accident. Except, of course, that Hrothgar was more to be feared than a tree or snake. It wasn't until later, when I was full grown, and Hrothgar was an old, old man, that I settled my soul on destroying him, slowly and cruelly. Except for his thane's occasional stories of seeing my footprints, he'd probably forgotten by then that I existed. He'd been busy. I'd watched it all from the eaves of the forest, mostly from up off the ground in the branches. In the beginning there were various groups of them, ragged little bands that roamed the forest on foot or horseback. Crafty-witted killers that worked in teams, hunting through the summer, shivering in caves or little huts in the winter, occasionally wandering out into the snow to plow through it slowly, clumsily, after more meat. Ice clung to their eyebrows and beards and eyelashes, and I'd hear them whining and groaning as they walked. When two hunters from different bands came together in the woods, they would fight until the snow was slushy with blood, then crawl back, gasping and crying, to their separate camps, to tell wild tales of what happened. As the bands grew larger, they would seize and clear a hill, and with the trees they'd cut would set up shacks, and on the crown of the hill a large, shaggy house with a steeply pitched roof and a wide stone hearth, where they'd all go at night for protection from other bands of men. The inside walls would be beautifully painted and hung with tapestries, and every cross timber or falcon's perch was carved and gewgawed with toads, snakes, dragon shapes, deer, cows, pigs, trees, trolls. At the first sign of spring they would set out their shrines and scatter seeds on the sides of the hill below the shacks, and would put up wooden fences to pen their pigs and cows. The women worked the ground and milked and fed the animals, while the men hunted. And when the men came in from the wolf roads at dusk, the women would cook the game they'd caught, while the men went inside and drank mead. Then they'd all eat, the men first, then the women and children, the men still drinking, getting louder and braver, talking about what they were going to do to the bands on the other hills. I would huddle, listening to their noise in the darkness, my eyebrows lifted, my lips pursed, the hair on the back of my neck standing up like pig's bristles. All the bands did the same thing. In time, I began to be more amused than revolted by what they threatened. It didn't matter to me what they did to each other. It was slightly ominous because of its strangeness. No wolf was so vicious to other wolves, but I half believed they weren't serious. They would listen to each other at the mead hall tables, their pinched, cunning rats' faces picking like needles at the boaster's words, the war falcons gazing down, black, from the rafters, and when one of them finished his raving threats, another would stand up and lift up his ram's horn, or draw his sword, or sometimes both if he was very drunk, and he'd tell them what he'd planned to do. Now and then some trivial argument would break out, and one of them would kill another one, and all the others would detach themselves from the killer as neatly as blood clotting, and they'd consider the case, and they'd either excuse him for some reason, or else send him out to the forest to live by stealing from their outlying pens like a wounded fox. At times I would try to befriend the exile, at other times I would try to ignore him, but they were treacherous. In the end, I had to eat them. As a rule, though, that wasn't how all their drinking turned out. Normally the men would howl out their daring, and the evening would get merrier, louder and louder, the king praising this one, criticizing that one, no one getting hurt except maybe some female who was asking for it, and eventually they'd all fall asleep on each other, like lizards. And I'd steal a cow. But the threats were serious. Darting unseen from camp to camp, I observed a change come over their drunken boasts. It was late spring. Food was plentiful. Every sheep and goat had its wobbly twins. The forest was teeming, and the first crops of the hillsides were coming into fruit. A man would roar, "I'll steal their gold and burn their mead hall," shaking his sword as if the tip were a fire, and a man with eyes like two pins would say, "Do it now, cowface! I think you're not even the man your father was." The people would laugh. I would back away into the darkness, furious at my stupid need to spy on them. And I would glide to the next camp of men, and I'd hear the same. Then, once, around midnight, I came to a hall in ruins. The cows in their pens lay burbling blood through their nostrils, with javelin holes in their necks. None had been eaten. The watchdogs lay like dark, wet stones, with their heads cut off, teeth bared. The fallen hall was a square of flames and acrid smoke. And the people inside, none of them had been eaten either, were burned black, small, like dwarfs turned dark and crisp. The sky opened like a hole where the gables had loomed before, and the wooden benches, the trestle tables, the beds that had hung on the mead hall walls were scattered to the edge of the forest, shining charcoal. There was no sign of the gold they'd kept, not so much as a melted hilt. Then the wars began, and the war songs, and the weapon-making. If the songs were true, as I suppose at least one or two of them were, there had always been wars, and what I'd seen was merely a period of mutual exhaustion. I'd be watching a mead hall from high in a tree, night birds singing in the limbs below me, the moon's face hidden in a tower of clouds, and nothing would be stirring except leaves moving in the light spring breeze, and down by the pig pens, two men walking with their battle axes and their dogs. Inside the hall I would hear the shaper telling of the glorious deeds of dead kings, how they'd split certain heads, snuck away with certain precious swords and necklaces, his harp mimicking the rush of swords, clanging boldly with the noble speeches, sighing behind the hero's dying words. Whenever he stopped, thinking up formulas for what to say next, the people would all shout and thump each other and drink to the shaper's long life. In the shadow of the hall and by the outbuildings, men sat whistling or humming to themselves, repairing weapons, winding bronze bands around gray ash spears, treating their sword blades with snake's venom, watching the gold worker decorate the handles of battle axes. The gold workers had an honored place. I remember one of them especially, a lean, aloof superior man of middle age. He never spoke to the others except to laugh sometimes,
Nye-he-he.
Then, suddenly, the birds below me in the tree